were not as strong, not as powerful. And from the start, they did face a, at best, provisional cooperation from the Confucian class. Furthermore, Mongol control, that is the control of the great Khan, of the other Ulus, starts to wane after 1294. Those other three Khanates go their separate ways. They will all eventually embrace Islam. And that will act as a divide between those three Khanates as well as the great Khan ruling in China and in the Mongol heartland. Furthermore, the later Yuan emperors made high demands. They made high military demands because there were rebels to crush. There were abortive expeditions, some of them sent into Indochina. There were vast building programs. It was the endowment of Buddhist monasteries. The Chinese, the Yuan emperors were accused of neglecting not only the Wei, the Confucian traditions, but also the management of the empire itself, above all the canal system. There's reports of repeated flooding, ruining of crops and silk production. All of these led to very heady combinations of the Buddhist apocalypse with traditional opposition to emperors who had lost the mandate of heaven, and it exploded in 1351. A peasant leader who proved to be a very, very capable opponent to the Yuan emperors, his name is Zhu Yuan Zhang. He headed up various dissident groups loosely labeled the Red Turbans. He actually spent more of his time defeating other dissident groups. And by 1356, he controlled most of South China and then brought these other groups into alliance. And in 1368, this man was able to proclaim himself the first Ming emperor. And he sent an expedition north against the Mongol capital, that is the former palace of Kublai Khan. And the then reigning Yuan emperor, a young man, essentially fled. Fled back to Mongolia and gave up the heritage. That is, henceforth, the Mongols would never again rule China. Well, the reoccupation of China by the Ming armies was a significant turning point. It led to the expulsion of the Mongols forever, and the Ming emperors carried out several important policies to demonstrate this. First and foremost, that Mongol capital was leveled, and a new city called Beijing was built on top of it. And Beijing was commenced in 1403. It was completed in the reign of the Emperor Yang Li, including the famous Forbidden City. And the later Mings actually made their capital at Beijing, which had initially been just a military base, in order to drive home the message to the descendants of Kublai Khan that the Mongols would never again be able to mess with the Chinese emperor. He was vigilant on that northern frontier. In addition, the Ming emperors ordered the reconstruction of the old Han and Tang walls. Now, I described that those earlier walls were really a set of fortresses, signal towers, monitoring stations. They did not represent the Maginot mentality that early scholars attributed to him. The walls that exist now are the masonry walls ordered by the Ming emperors, and this was more of an emotional, psychological response to the humiliation that China had been once ruled by Mongols, by nomads, by people who were not of the Han peoples. And this would never happen again. And it is ironic that in moving their capital to Beijing, to expending enormous amount of efforts on building the Great Wall, that the Ming emperors failed to guard against the threat they didn't see, and that again came from the forest of Manchuria, when in 1644, a new people, a people of the forest, the Manchus, entered China, overthrew the Ming dynasty, and ruled in the fashion of a Sinified set of conquerors. You never are overthrown by the threat you guard against. It's always the one you don't expect. The Ming emperors learned that lesson to their dismay and grief. Now, the situation in China differed from the other three Ulus. In Central Asia, the Jagatai Khans were able to prosper off the Silk Road, and they ruled a very odd Khanate in the 14th century that really had three components. One of those components, and perhaps the most important, were the central steppes. We've talked about them before. They are essentially extending from the regions around the Aral Sea, the upper Jaxartes. They move east to about the Altai mountain range. On those steppes were various Turkish and Mongol tribes, and they preserved the traditions of Genghis Khan. They followed the notions of Yasa, that is, the authority of the Khan overrode all religious law, all other customs. They also were proud of their steppe heritage. They didn't want to live in cities. They were very disdainful of cosmopolitan cities. And they essentially claimed to be the true Mongols, even though most of them spoke Turkish. And the region is often known as Mogolistan or Mongolstan, is a Mongol area from which the later Mogol emperors of India take their name. And we'll talk about that in a later lecture. They also included the Tarim Basin, the caravan cities. These cities steadily went over to Islam. They steadily adopted the Uyghur Turkish. And by the opening of the 15th century, Buddhism had passed. The great Buddhist monasteries and cities such as Turfan, Dungwan had all passed out of existence. And instead, you have a Turkish-speaking Uyghur population tied to the nomads of the central steppes and to the caravan cities of Transoxiana. That was the third component. The great cities we've talked about so much, Samarkand, Bukhara, those were a point of contention between the Jagatide Khans ruling on the central steppes with their kinsmen, the Ilkhans of Persia, and eventually the Ilkhans will lose out. And when their Khanate fragments in 1353 into competing states, Transoxiana is then again part of that central Ulus. In that region, the population went Islamic. But there's two important points I wish to stress. The Jagatide Khans never pursued their Islam rigorously or zealously. They tolerated other faiths. Furthermore, they always kept touch with the steppe traditions and the importance of yasma, that is, the law of the Khan. And these two concepts will prove extremely important because the successor of this tradition will turn out to be a down, out-of-luck descendant of both Tamerlane and Genghis Khan called Babur. And he will take these traditions over the Hindu Kush and use them to construct the Mughal Empire, the great imperial order of India, the predecessor of the Raj. But the birth of that Raj owed a great deal to that steppe tradition passed through the Jagatide Khans and going back to Genghis Khan. Let us look at the Ilkhans of Persia. They ruled the second most prosperous of the Ulus, second to China. They were certainly engaged in all of the trade and the cultural exchange we talked about. Hulagu and his successors long maintained a cosmopolitan court. They were great sponsors of Buddhism. And some of the greatest thinkers and scholars in the cultural exchange worked at Tabriz. And conversion to Islam did not result in the Ilkhans embracing Islam to the disadvantage of the other faiths. And I mentioned that Buddhist monasteries still flourished into the early 14th century. Now, the situation will change in the 14th century. Islam will mount a recovery. The later Ilkhans will be more orthodox in their beliefs. And after the fall of the Ilkhans family, it's essentially finished in 1353, Buddhism loses all patronage and essentially disappears in Iran and Transoxiana after that brief revival. You can get some sense of the cultural diversity of faiths and of cult of intellectual achievement among the Ilkhans by looking at some of the people they patronized. There was a very, I mentioned, of course, that earlier scholar, Rashid al-Din, who is very important. But there's another one. He was a Mongol prince who had served in the court of Genghis Khan. His name was Bolad Akka. He had, he had served at the court of Kublai Khan, and he had been in the forefront of a number of important administrative tasks entrusted to him by Kublai Khan. He, for instance, had been trained in Chinese in the Confucian classics. He supervised translations of agricultural works. He supervised the improvement of agriculture in the reign of Kublai Khan, streamlined the yuan bureaucracy, devised a system of appointments and recommendations that Kublai Khan liked. And then in 1285, he was sent as an envoy by Kublai Khan to Kublai Khan's nephew, the then reigning Ilkhan of Tabriz. Because of wars on the steppes, a temporary civil war, Bulut decided to stay at Tabriz and offer his services to the Ilkhanate court. And he spent the rest of his career carrying out important translations of Chinese works into Persian. He introduced a lot of court ceremony, dress, tastes, aesthetics from China, and he epitomizes the type of exchange that went on between these two courts and had far wider ramifications than just what happened at the courts, because it enriched the high culture of Eastern Islam, that Persian culture. It introduced the court at Tabriz to Chinese porcelains and silks, all sorts of ritual and protocol, and it becomes the basis for the great three Muslim empires of the early modern period, often called the gunpowder empires, the Ottoman Sultanate, the Safavid Shahs of Iran, and the Mughal emperors of India. That cultural mix that was shared by those three great states before the coming of the Europeans, the European impact on the Islamic world, goes back really to these achievements of the Ilkhanate court, that is, the family of Hulagu, a man who had been no friend to Islam and had cut wide swathes of destruction in his conquest of Iran and Iraq. Therefore, the Ilkhanate court, in a way, was converted and assimilated into the wider Islamic world. But that Islamic world owed a great debt to the Ilkhans for its enrichment and its revival of Islamic architecture in Islamic intellectual activities. To me, the Ilkhanate court is the intellectual and cultural success of the whole Mughal Empire. Whatever Kublai Khan achieved in China ended up being expelled. It was short-lived. The Jagatai Khans and the Khans of the Golden Horde never played that same cultural role, but the family of Hulagu get high marks in my mind for what they achieved in the rebirth of Islamic civilization in the lands of Eastern Islam. Well, finally, let us turn to the last Ulus. That is popularly known as the Golden Horde. It was known under a number of names, and this is the family of Batu. Batu transmitted power to his brother, Berke. I mentioned that Berke proved a very devout Muslim. He came to the throne in 1227, and he had, however, converted earlier to Islam under the impact of a Sufi mystic. And Berke is the first of the Mongol rulers that we know who puts religion as a loyalty above kinship. Berke aligns very quickly with the Mamluk sultans of Cairo. He is furnishing the slave soldiers, mostly Kipchak and Kuban Turks who've been enslaved in tribal warfare and who are being sold through the Genoese colony of Kaffa, or the later the Venetian colony at Taman, which is just at the mouth of the Kuban River. And these were two great slave entrepôts. The Venetian and Genoese carried these slaves who became the basis of Mamluk power. Berke was not displeased when he heard the news of the defeat of his cousin's army, Hulagu, at the Battle of Ayin Jalut. Furthermore, these later Khans at their palace city of Sarai pursued a policy similar to their kinsmen in Central Asia. They were standoffish about urban civilization. They embraced Turkish. They liked the simpler Islam that was appropriate to nomadic peoples, particularly of Sufis and of mystics. Many of the tribes in the Confederation were quite unconventional in their Islamic beliefs. I mentioned that in an earlier lecture in the questions of conversion, that when the Russians came to later catalog these tribes as were they Islamic, were they Christian, were they Buddhist, Russian census takers became very frustrated and essentially cataloged them by ethnicity and language because the Islamic religious practices were so unconventional and looked so on Muslim to the Russians. Well, this Khanate also exercised control over the Russian principalities. That was a result of the victories of Batu. And the Russians have a historical memory that has been augmented by national histories that they suffered under the Tatar yoke. And that Tatar yoke really hamstrung or perverted Russian development. That is a simplification. The Russian princes were never agreed on anything. They always fought each other quite happily. But the Russian princes who played ball with the Khans of the Sarai, at Sarai, they prospered very well. And one of the most important ones was Prince Ivan of Moscow. He proved a very loyal vassal of the Golden Horde. He proved loyal in a very important civil war. And in 1328, the then ruling Khan Uzuk entrusted Ivan with the collection of tribute from the Russian princes that was owed to the Khan. Now, this was a great deal for Moscow. The Khan also threw in some important cities like Vladimir and others. And Moscow emerges at the nexus of the river routes that link up the whole systems of the Don, the Dnieper, and the Volga. They gain a very, very important principality by 1328, and they also are the collection agency for the Mongol Khans. This Ivan is remembered affectionately as Ivan the Moneybags, Ivan Kalita in Russian, and that's because he amassed resources and money at the expense of his fellow princes in paying off the Khans. There is, however, an important point to note. The Khans of the Golden Horde very quickly came to realize their vulnerability vis-a-vis the Russian princes. This was dramatically revealed in 1380. It didn't end at this battle, the Battle of Kulukovo, which is occurred on September 18, 1380, and is still celebrated as a great heroic event in Russia. It by no means ended the Mongol yoke. But it did point out that the Mongol army could be defeated. The then reigning prince of Moscow, Vasily I, put together a coalition of Russian princes, and this army marched to the Don and surprised a Mongol army on the Don in September. They came out of the mists. They were unexpected. The Mongols had been, the Mongols were waiting for reinforcements, and in a very, very hard-fought battle, in which the Russians mounted heavy cavalry, European style, the Russians won. A number of the princes fell mortally wounded, but for the first time, the Russians beat a Mongol army. This was a significant event. It did not, however, lead to the overthrow of Mongol rule. The Khan, Toktamish, ruling at Sarai, he immediately summoned his protector, Tamerlane, and vast numbers of forces came from Central Asia, and very quickly, Vasily of Moscow and the other princes were brought back to heel. They immediately gave their loyalty back to the Mongol Khan. And it would be really another 120 years before that kind of overlordship would end. But the battle was a significant turning point. It proved that Mongol cavalry could be defeated, and that the Russians were getting better and better at mounting the sort of armies that could defeat the Mongols, and they had access to the Western technology. Two important events occurred that tipped the balance in the course of the 14th century, and by 1500, the Russians had essentially, the czars of the princes of Moscow had turned themselves into the czars of Russia and were on the march to conquer the steppes. The first was the Golden Horde itself. It broke up into a series of competing khanates, the Khanate of the Crimea, the Khanate of Astrakhan, the Khanate of Kazan. All of these states engaged in the slave trade and, starting in 1453, supplied slave soldiers and slaves to the court of the Ottoman Sultan. And they came to depend on the Ottoman Sultan for military support, technical advice, and even money. And so the Golden Horde, in effect, fragmented and became clients of the Ottoman Sultan in Constantinople. Meanwhile, the Grand Princes of Moscow were not idle. They embraced the new military technology of handheld firearms and artillery. That included the primitive firearms known as the arquebus, the disciplined infantry that could fire them, and above all, field artillery. And so in 1480, Prince Ivan III decided to engage the army of the Khans, and there was a battle on a tributary of the Volga, a very important battle, sometimes known as the Battle of the Ugra River, in which the Russian army lined up on one side, the Mongols on the other, and the Mongols were very, very hesitant, and for Mongols, read largely Turks or Tartars, were very hesitant to attack the Russian army. And as the river froze in December, the Mongols retreated into the steppes, and Ivan kind of ridiculously declared a victory. But in effect, it was a victory. From there, he and his successor, the famous Ivan the Terrible, went on to conquer Kazan and Astrakhan. They gained control of the Volga. The Khans of the Crimea lingered on as vassals of the Ottoman Sultan, but the steppes were now in the hands of the princes of Moscow, who turned themselves into the Tsars of Russia. And they had the firearms and the artillery to conquer the Eurasian steppes, as well as the incentive. Starting from 1500 on, the Tsars entrusted to the Stroganov family the right to collect the furs of Siberia. It was the fur trade, the colonization by military colonists armed with firearms and backed up by Cossacks starting in the 17th century, who were the Russians' response to Mongol cavalry, that led to the rapid expansion of Russian power across the tundra, the taiga, and the steppe zones. And the result is that the movement, which has for so long been from east to west, now goes from west to east. The success of the Russians is symbolized at the Treaty of Nerchinsk in 1689. And that was an agreement by the then very, very young Tsar, Peter the Great, and his brother, Ivan, with the then Qin court, that is the Manchu emperors of China who have overthrown the Ming. And that partition has been essentially redone several times, but that partition essentially resulted in the steppes falling into the hands of the Russians and the Chinese. The Russian Tsar got most of the steppes and Transoxiana. The Chinese eventually got Tibet, the Tarim Basin, Inner Mongolia, and the Mongolian heartland was preserved as a buffer between the two empires. And this division has dictated politics and geopolitics ever since. It is ironic to me that the Golden Horde, which in some ways was the greatest military force in 1294, resulted in galvanizing the Russian princes, the czars of Moscow, to adopt the military technology, which they had gained under the Mongol peace, to march across the steppes, conquer those steppes, and forever end the military power of nomadic horse archers.
Lecture 34, Tamerlane, Prince of Destruction.
In this lecture, I plan to open up with the career of Tamerlane, or Timur, as he's known in his actual name. And Tamerlane and Babur, who is a descendant of Tamerlane, will form the last two narrative lectures of this course. They are both great conquerors of the steppes. They are both heirs to the Mongol legacy. And as we'll see in this lecture and the next lecture, they represent an important contrast as to what is the standard for a successful conqueror to get in that gallery with Attila the Hun and Genghis Khan. Tamerlane is probably a distant third of the great steppe conquerors. He's not recognized as quickly as Attila the Hun and Genghis Khan. Yet, for my money, he has one of the best titles. He was usually called Prince of Destruction. He would have preferred the name Sword of Islam, but he really shed too much Muslim blood and sacked too many Muslim cities to deserve that title. as a result of his career, and it is a very mixed career, as we shall see, Tamerlane has really two faces, two portraits that have come down to us in the contemporary literature. On the one hand, he is hailed as that sword of Islam, that great heroic Muslim conqueror. And that comes through in history that was written shortly after his death by a Persian historian, Sharif ad-Din Ali Yazdi. And he pens an account in which Tamerlane is a great noble Muslim prince. He's almost in the guise of the great defenders of Islam who had fought the Crusaders. And this work has come down to us with a great deal of details about the reign, particularly Tamerlane's earlier career, how he got the name Tamerlane, or Timur the Lame, because he was wounded very early in his career in his hip, and that resulted in the conqueror having a limp throughout his life. That was in the fighting in the 1360s, where he established himself as the effective ruler of Samarkand. On the other hand, we have a number of stories about his atrocities, and that's led to a very different picture. We have accounts shortly after his death discussing how he had been a brutal conqueror, that, yes, he was interested in talking to Muslim theologians. There's even a story about him meeting the famous historian Ibn Khaldun, very, very well known for his account of Muslim dynasties, usually looked upon as one of the great historians of traditional Islam. This occurs at the Siege of Damascus, and it's something of a conceit. Even so, the accounts shortly after his death are filled with pages about massacres and brutalities, atrocities really on the order of the worst atrocities committed by Genghis Khan, Hulagu, and Batu. So in this way, Tamerlane presents us a very, very mixed picture. His contemporaries were often shocked by his brutality. Muslim authors saw him as really a very often a barbarian conqueror with only a marginal claim to being the sword of Islam. And anyway, that was a title he picked up while he was battling in India, where he sacked some Hindu temples, and later when he destroyed churches in Georgia and Armenia. Most of the fury of Tamerlane's army was really directed against Muslim opponents. We have some colorful incidents about him, and several facts become clear from both accounts, and they agree on this one point, that is both the negative and the positive accounts on Tamerlane. He had that same powerful, charismatic personality that we had seen in Genghis Khan and in his successful grandsons. He also relished terror on an order that is really quite extraordinary. And sometimes these acts of terror, which were again within the Mongol tradition of demoralizing your foes, seemed to be almost gratuitous and almost experimental. For instance, on several occasions, he orders great towers of skulls of the decapitated prisoners to be piled up on the plain. There are accounts where garrisons surrender and Tamerlane promises, "I'm not going to shed any of your blood," and then has these poor guys immured in walls. He does that on several occasions, both in Iran and in Asia Minor. On the eve of one of his greatest battles outside of Delhi in 1398,